From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's easy to get cute about religious practices that seem odd or mysterious, and Latter-day Saints often take a hit when the subject of their temple garments come up in popular culture. Magic underwear is the term you hear all the time. Well, the church seems to be sick of it, and recently they released a video not only urging people to be respectful, but also explaining what the garments are about. The video didn't get terribly specific, of course, but it did take a lot of people by surprise because Mormons don't really talk about their garments in public. For us, it provided an opportunity to discuss garments, the history of them, where they fit among other ritual clothing, and how the faithful themselves describe the meaning of garments in their lives. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints released a video a few weeks ago explaining certain aspects of Mormon temple garments, it caused quite a stir. For observers outside the faith, the video seemed pretty benign. While it showed an actual image of the garments themselves, it didn't go into any detail about their part in the LDS temple ritual. Mostly, it seemed the video was designed to urge people to be respectful and also to fit garments into a larger tradition of religious clothing. They're like a nun's habit, the video said, or a Jewish prayer shawl. But within the faith, many Mormons were conflicted about the video. If you look at the comments section, for example, in the Deseret News, you'll see how one reader said she was glad the church released it, but didn't think it was a topic for discussion. One LDS reader believed that it violated the church's rules, that garments are simply too sacred to talk about in public. Well, today in the program, we are going to talk about Mormon temple garments. We're going to look at the history of them, where they fit in other sacred clothing traditions, and also what Mormons themselves think about them. And we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us throughout the hour is Colleen McDaniel, a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah. Among her books is Material Christianity, Religion and Popular Culture in America, which includes a chapter on Mormon temple garments. And we should also mention she's currently working on a history of Mormon women since polygamy. And Professor McDaniel, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to sort of get this out of the way and say at the outset that we're aware this is a sensitive subject for Latter-day Saints. A style guide given to the media from the church asks us to report on the subject with respect, which, of course, we intend to do today. We're going to be careful not to get too explicit about some of the particular elements of the temple ceremony, which can be pretty delicate for Mormons. So let me begin, Professor, with the video itself. You've taken note of the fact that Mormon leaders and mainstream members don't really like to talk about the things related to their temples, sacred rituals, things like that. So how big of a deal is it, do you think, that the church itself released this video?
I think it's a very significant change in their attitudes about controversial and sensitive topics. And obviously, it's within a larger context of releases by the church on African Americans and the priesthood, on the questions of polygamy, on Joseph Smith's early celestial marriages. So this is something where the internet and I think their own members have wanted definitive and helpful statements so that they can understand these difficult topics, difficult in terms of what non-Mormons think about
them.
Right,
right. It's interesting. One of the things you write in your book is that because the church in the past has insisted on silence about this, that church authorities have, here's how you put it, tacitly created an environment for a variety of personal interpretations. So they want you to be quiet about it because it's for obvious reasons. But then you get all these different kind of interpretations, these different spins on the story from Mormons.
Well, you know, this is these are very sensitive and intense acts and unusual acts. And, you know, people think about this. They might not discuss it with friends or families, but in their own heads, they're trying to understand and negotiate the meanings, the sacred meanings, and how this connects with their commitments to the church and to God in general. And so I think many Mormons, and this is what I talked about in the book, really have profound and interesting thoughts on it, but they're not theologians. They're not trained. They don't have an outlet. Although now with the internet, and, you know, my book was written before the internet, right. Now there is an outlet for people to discuss what are the feelings, the emotional, the spiritual uplift that, you know, that these rituals and this in wearing garments give people.
Your book, as you mentioned, was written several years ago now. In it, though, you say that scholarly analysis, whether it's well-intentioned or whether it's not, even casual conversations have been seen as kind of profane, sacred subjects. So what was it like then? What do you figure it's like now to research Mormon temple garments? I mean, I guess it was hard to find things to really pin it down.
Well, as I mentioned in the book, I think people want to talk about these things. They feel like there are a set of points or issues that they cannot discuss, but they do want to talk about how these objects help their commitment to the church. When I first started doing the research, however, I presented an early version of the essay at a Sunstone symposium. And there are other essays that also were given at that point. And then there was an issue from the First Presidency basically telling, you know, Mormons to be careful about such symposia because they might not be respectful to things that the Mormons hold sacred. And that was a very strong, chilling wind that blew through the church in the early and mid-90s, which I'm sure your listeners know all about. And so it was difficult, especially for Mormons who wanted to explore certain historical topics, controversial topics. They knew that if they did, it could risk their job if they were teaching at BYU or if they were working at the church or if they wanted to get a job in the future at one of these places. So I'm very lucky. You know, I have a wonderful position at the University of Utah. I'm a reputable scholar, and I felt like I could say things about garments that both respected my own informants, but also had a certain scholarly edge to it that I felt also shed light on the history and meanings of garments.
The early history of garments, you mentioned not easy to determine. Of course, the church withholds documents that they consider sacred or private, so that must have been difficult, even though they may consider you a reputable scholar, they probably withhold a lot of that stuff. And you write this in your book that Mormon church leaders have not articulated an origin myth for garments that explains how they came to wear these clothes. So you have to just piece things together, right? Find fragments, I mean, and see if you can get a narrative from that.
I think it's interesting about the video because the video also doesn't give any kind of historical background. It doesn't say this is what Joseph Smith said, this was a revelation. It works very hard to take garments out of a sacred narrative. So they're not pointing to a set of sacred scriptures that would say this is why we wear something. So I think that's what you mean by, you know, there is not an origin story. So basically, if we can talk about four different places where garments may have come from. The first could be Mormons would say there's a tradition that an angel gave the design to Joseph Smith, and then Joseph Smith had found a seamstress and she designed the first set of garments. I mean, historians also, if we put that aside, the kind of sacred origin, they also would say there are similarities with Masonic activities.
Well, hold on. I want to let's talk about that one first.
Okay.
So the story that Joseph Smith receives a visitation from an angel, and then he goes and finds a seamstress in town, basically. And tell that story, because I think it's interesting. I mean, he basically has her work out a couple of designs. I mean, he's designing the temple.
Exactly.
Right?
But first, as the good historian, I have to say that this is, you know, this is like much of Mormon history. This is a series of oral histories that someone told it to someone who told it to someone. And so, you know, I think the church hierarchy is correct in not making a statement in that short video about this. So, but the story is that Joseph Smith learned the pattern and then found someone. They made three different tries until he liked it properly. Again, the tradition is that Emma Smith thought it was a little rugged, and so she asked them, or maybe it was Eliza Snow, to put a little collar on it so that it looked more finished. And so these are the kinds of oral traditions that, you know, we think might have been the very earliest sense of it. But I think the bottom line there is that it was something which was not definitive, that people were changing, that they weren't quite exactly sure should it have buttons or strings or what color should the trim be? These are all questions that were up in the air.
First garments, muslin or linen, worn next to the skin, and they were pretty long. I mean, they reached down to the wrists and down to the ankles.
Right. Remember, we're in the 19th century. Yeah. Where everyone is wearing long clothes to begin with.
And so that probably wasn't terribly unusual.
And also, you should also have a sense that our own underwear that we wear now is much more sexualized than it was in the 19th century. I mean, this was not... there was no Victoria's Secrets, so you had really plain
union suits,
simple,
and,
exactly. You know, long what we might consider long johns,
yeah.
And that was just standard. That was just what people wore. But as I talk about in the book, as fashion changes, then the church has to make a decision: do we change how the garments look, or do we continue to insist that they are sacred and that they shouldn't change, and then we stand out from the rest of the American population.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that because I think that's interesting, how they've changed. It's interesting, you write, we think that this clothing was made inside the temple in those first early years. Mostly Mormon leaders' wives made it. And you say Brigham Young really struggled to get the temple garments the same. Everyone was sort of doing different versions or whatever. I guess that drove him crazy. He hated that. He wanted to standardize it.
Well, Brigham Young was a very practical person.
Yeah.
And so he spent more time working about sort of the practical nature of this thing than the theology behind it. He didn't try to explain the wider meaning of them.
You're right. This was interesting. I hadn't realized this. You say that all kinds of things were going on in the temple in those days. I mean, people were eating in the rooms and there was dancing and some people were spending the night. And Brigham Young kind of put an end to that. He no longer wanted people sewing temple clothes inside the temple itself. He really sort of buttoned it up.
Right. And I think in general, that's how the temple activities have been going. It's towards more quiet, more respect. There used to be healing going on in the temple. There used to be speaking in tongues going on, much more spontaneous activities. And over the decades, it's become more fixed, quieter, more respectful, more reverential.
Can you find much in Mormon scripture itself about the garments?
No, it doesn't exist in the Doctrine and Covenants. So there's not a specific revelation or something that says, and wear this and wear it in this way. Now, obviously, there are comments about, you know, the promises, what God gives people in sort of general ways, but nothing specific.
So I can't figure out, is there an actual story, but they just don't want to tell it? Or is it just that there isn't one? I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, people are relying on this story. Well, we think maybe Joseph Smith had a vision, but that's, you can't read about that, at least not in official documents. At least they're not saying that. It's mostly sort of folklore.
Right.
So if you can't
but
pin
much
it down,
but much of
it?
Mormon history is oral tradition. It's passing down. It really, if you think about it, it's not until the early 20th century that even the liturgy of the temple or of healing or other things were written down.
Right.
So these very sacred and important things were passed orally from respected leader to respected leader. And that's not unusual in the history of religions. I mean, oral traditions for many religious cultures, that's where the most powerful thing is, in the word, not in the written instructions.
But see, it's interesting because Mormons are so good about making a record. They take a record. They have a record of everything. So do you think somewhere in a vault somewhere there is a list of, there's a story, or is it just, sorry, it's not there. It's just an oral tradition. It came to us this way, and this is what they believe. And or do you think something is out there?
I don't think there is a story. Yeah. I don't think there's an oral tradition. I don't think that there is a smoking gun somewhere. I think this is a something which occurred organically that developed over time. As I mentioned in the book, there are these other influences.
Which we'll get to, by the way.
And so really I don't think that there is something that's being hidden away, that the church has a, you know, there was this special vision, a secret vision. Absolutely not. I think it is very organic, natural thing that happened that was a part of the whole environment of the temple and the environment of reconstituting, you know, Israel.
A lot of Latter-day Saints mention that wearing garments really, that isn't that unique. You know, a lot of people have religious vestments. In the video, they mention a nun's habit and a priest's cassock and a Jewish prayer shawl, among others. But you also write about the fact that while it may be true they fit into a bigger tradition, Mormon garments, that Mormon garments are also pretty unique in certain ways. The way Mormons wear their garments don't, in fact, duplicate how sacred clothing is worn in other religious groups. Explain that. How are they different?
Well, the film is interesting. The film, of course, is very visual. So you see these bright religious vestments, and you see Catholic nuns' outfits that many Catholic sisters haven't worn since the 1950s. And so they're trying to put themselves in this larger world religions tradition, which in general is the trajectory that the church tries to do. But Mormons always are trying to do both and. So they want to be special and unique, but they also want to be mainstream. Those vestments, those garbs that Catholics wear and so on, they tend to distinguish people. So the Catholic sister is wearing a distinctive habit because she is a consecrated woman. She has devoted her life to the church. She doesn't marry.
She's from a particular order.
She has a particular order. Yeah. She's a Dominican or a Franciscan. That says something about the kinds of acts that she does religiously. Or other groups, religious groups, men will wear certain clothes. For instance, the Jewish underclothes that Jewish men wear, women don't wear. So most religious clothing distinguishes people, whereas one of the things that garments does is it blends so that men and women don't look so different in the garments, that there is not this distinction between the official high hierarchical leaders and the average individuals. They actually mention that in the video.
Yeah, they're proud of that.
That's important. And that is something which is different from other religious communities. And also, I think I also want to point out, I mean, the vestments that they showed in the video, the non-Mormons, they tend to be much more traditional vestments. And there's a lot of controversy, for instance, in Catholicism, about what kinds of religious habits a nun should wear. And obviously, everybody knows that in the early 1970s, those habits became very small and very modest. And now many Catholic sisters, probably I'd say the majority of Catholic sisters, wear no habits at all. And so the trend up until very recently has been to simplify religious clothing or do away with it entirely. Now, however, there are traditionalists who want to bring back these more vivid vestments because they want to bring back the power of the religious people who are wearing them. So when you have these religious clothing, they distinguish rank. And some people, some Catholics, think that priests have lost their importance and Catholic sisters have lost the respect that they deserve. And it's because they just look like average people and they just wear, you know, clothing that anyone can buy at the store. And so there's an important shift going on with how clothing is understood.
How unique is it that the Mormon temple garment is designed to be worn next to the skin, close to the body.
I think that that's a very important. It's the level of intimacy. And for instance, in the Jewish underclothes, you do not wear it next to the skin. And I, from what I can understand now, even that's beginning to change with an LDS culture. There seems to be a little flexibility now, maybe some inconsistencies about what kinds of instructions, especially women, are given about where to wear the garments.
They're, like whether to wear a bra over them, I guess, right?
Right. Yeah. So over or under, there seems to be a bit more flexibility. If you speak with people who are older, maybe who have had their garments for a long time, they would say, oh, no, that's not the case. You know, I was taught that they had to be next to your skin. But I think what the church is doing, and this is typical from the very beginning, is they're trying to be flexible. They're trying to realize, you know, when you go to really hot places, it might not be possible to have so much clothing next to your skin. So I think there's a lot of, over the years, they have just become much more adaptable to the reality of living.
In the modern world.
Yeah. Exactly.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about some of the historical influences that may have influenced the LDS temple garment. Colleen McDaniel is with us, a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah, author of the book Material Christianity, Religion and Popular Culture in America. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Mormon temple garments. As many of you know, this is a deeply sensitive subject for Latter-day Saints. But when the church released a video recently explaining certain aspects of those garments, it got us wondering where they fit in a larger picture of other sacred clothing that acts as a symbol for a religious commitment. We've asked Professor Colleen McDaniel to join us. She's a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah to talk about all of this. She's done some research on Mormon temple garments and where they fit in the scheme of things. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So you mentioned ritual clothing wasn't a significant part of 19th century Protestantism anyway, but it was important for some groups. And in the book, you speculate or write about, research, explore this idea that the Mormon temple garment was influenced by a couple of strands here, and I wanted to break these down. Let's start with Freemasonry. And just tell me generally what you think the influence is here, because the primary piece of Masonic ceremonial clothing is the apron. That's also a part of Mormon, if not the Mormon garment itself, Mormon temple garments itself. Clothing itself. So what's the influence, do you figure, on the temple garment from Freemasonry?
Well, Joseph Smith and many of the male leaders of the early church were Freemasons and had been initiated into this fraternal society. And in general, that was very popular in the United States at that period as well. There were many men who were involved in Freemasonry, and then in the late 19th century in other fraternal groups. And those men had a very elaborate ritual system that included gestures and signs and symbols, special clothing, aspects of a culture that they did not experience in the Methodist Church or the Puritan churches of the 18th century and 17th century. Mm. And so this was a different kind of organization that had religious elements that some people might think would be more Catholic than Protestant. So because the Mormon leaders were involved in this and they understood that the Masonic rites had elements of the truth, they could call on those symbols and put those symbols, use those symbols in their art and in their clothing and in other places. And so there are crossovers. If you look, for instance, at markers on graves or some of the markers on the exteriors of the temples, they come from Masonic symbols. And so there was this crossover. One of the things that I mentioned in the book, though, is the Masonic apron was a public thing. Masons marched in parades, and they wore—
Benjamin Franklin had an apron from his Masonic lodge.
They wore their special insignias. Again, an insignia of rank, showing, you know, where they are in this cosmic hierarchy. And so there is, again, both the temple robes and the temple garment are different in that regards. But the connections in terms of wearing something, there has this layering of Masonic activities.
It's interesting. You could not see, and I know this is maybe, I'll be delicate here. You could not see in that video the markings on LDS garments, which is interesting. I'm not sure how much we should say about that, but those markings, I think there's some sense that they're related to Masonic markings, and that is a part of the Mormon temple garment.
Right, exactly.
There you go. I want to ask you about folk magic, because that's another element that you write about that could have had an influence on the Mormon temple garment. A number of early Mormons were involved in folk magic. I don't think that's any great controversy. Joseph Smith, of course, among them. What kind of influence did that have on Mormon garments itself?
Again, I think you want to see it as, you know, what is going on in American culture in the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s. Obviously, you have American Protestantism coming out of a Calvinist tradition that doesn't like any kind of material culture, that tries to simplify things, tries to distance itself from anything that would look like something Catholics would do. So no relics and no saints and none of these objects that have a lot of spiritual power. But then you have in American culture these folk traditions that say rocks have power and the sky has power and water has power. And if you look at the way nature arranges itself, you can understand things in certain ways. And so Mormonism is a part of that general tradition of saying the physical world is not separate from the supernatural world. The physical world actually expresses the supernatural world. The power of the natural world can come and be used by God, that there is fluidity between the natural and the supernatural world, whereas Protestants wanted to distinguish it and separate it and say, oh, miracles and speaking in tongues, that's over. That ended with the apostles. But Mormonism says, no, that's the wonder of Joseph Smith. We're opening up the heavens. And so you can see then how objects like stones or water or clothing or signs can have some kind of a special meaning. Again, this is in the 19th century. It was very clear in the video that the current church is distancing itself from any kind of a spiritual power.
I wanted to mention that. Latter-day Saints, I think for the most part, hate the term magic underwear.
They don't— For good reason.
I mean, they don't even like the idea, as was said in the video, that this is somehow magical. Here's what the video says. It says, these words not only are inaccurate, but also are offensive to members of the church. There is nothing magical or mystical about temple garments. So put that modern day statement in the context of the 19th century, if you would, because in the early days, this idea of Mormon garments being an actual physical protection was pretty important. And you write about how in Mormon folklore, it's packed with stories of people who say garments, if maybe they weren't magical, but they certainly protected you from, you know, from attacking Indians and other kinds of dangers.
I think what you have with garments is people experience this intimate object and they have things happen in their lives and they begin to tell stories about what happens in their lives. This has nothing to do with the theology of the church or what the church is actually saying about it, but they have their own personal experiences. And so even though they would not think that the garment itself physically has any kind of power. In the process of telling stories, they tap into that power. They tap into that mystery. And that's what makes it, that's what makes people want to wear garments, is because there is the sense that they are something special. If you have, it's just like everything else, then you could ask yourself, why am I being discomforted to wear this? And so it's in the storytelling process, and people will always say, I don't know if this is true or not, but, and then they tell the story, which allows them to kind of put one little toe into that mystical water. And actually, as a historian of religion, I think it's unfortunate that the church wants to downplay the fact that these are special things. I mean, anything that is, you have to do all the time, it's so intimate, it has to be special to you. If it's just commonplace, why don't we just put the signs on a little medal and wear the medal? It would be a lot easier and much more comfortable. And think of all the time and energy the church spends on designing and marketing and selling and experimenting on new fabrics. They could just have a little medal and that would be easy. But people have something sacred and special that comes from that interaction.
You believe Joseph Smith may have gotten some of his idea for the temple garments from 19th century Judaism. Let's talk about that. What do we figure is the influence?
Right, not so much 19th century Judaism, but from biblical Judaism, because he is very carefully reading the Hebrew Bible. He's reading the Old Testament. He's looking at what kinds of priestly acts and priestly clothing are discussed in the Old Testament. And part of that sense that we are a kingdom of priests and priestesses, and they wear special clothing. So you don't have to go to the Masons. You don't have to go to folk traditions. You can just go to your Bible, and you can take seriously the Hebrew Bible and see these kinds of clothing and objects that might be worn.
Of the three, Freemasonry, you know, folk magic, and Judaism, it seems like Judaism is the one they really embrace. They absolutely, Mormons, seem to make a connection between temple garments and sacred clothing in Judaism.
Right, and obviously because the Hebrew Bible is a part of, you know, Christian worship process. Many Christians hold this as a special text, whereas Masons and folk tradition, I mean, those are a little suspect. But it makes sense that you would go back to quoting the sacred scriptures.
What do we see in the Hebrew Bible or in the Old Testament about religious or ritual clothing? You mentioned God commands Aaron and his sons to wear linen breeches, for example. What do we see in the Bible?
Again, it is a distinction between those people who are allowed to approach the divine center in the temple and those who are not. And so it is not everyone, and it's certainly not women, and it's only a certain class of Israelites who are allowed to get this close. So it's a level of distinction.
I want to ask you about... Well, let me take a break first here, because I want to get to how Mormons themselves talk about the relationship with their garments, because I think this is really interesting. Some of the people that you talked to when you were preparing the book, but also comments that we're getting ourselves, comments that we've taken from the Deseret News, which I think is interesting itself, gives you a sense of how Mormons themselves are talking about not only the video that was released, but their own relationship with these religious garments. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Colleen McDaniel is with us. She teaches history and religious studies at the University of Utah. Her book, which deals in all of this, is called Material Christianity, Religion, and Popular Culture in America. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Mormon temple garments. a deeply sensitive subject we acknowledge among Latter-day Saints, but the church released a video recently explaining certain aspects of garments, which gives us an opportunity to talk a little bit about them. We're here with Professor Colleen McDaniel, teaches history and religious studies at the University of Utah, has a book called Material Christianity, Religion and Popular Culture in America. And we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Let's take a call from Stephen, who's with us in Magna. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was just curious about, I know in Mormonism, at least it appears that they're very secretive about the things that they hold sacred. And I'm curious as to whether that's something that's seen broadly in religions or if it's unique to Mormonism.
This is something that you write about, this idea of, how do you put it in your book? Let me see if I can find this. Power and secrecy is an element. You say, in fact, that it was the most frequent narrative you found among Mormons, that they weren't talking about how their garments protected them, but it was two things. You say power and secrecy. Talk about that.
Well, I think that what you've got is anytime somebody is excluded from something, you want to know, well, what's there? What's going on with that? And there is this linkage between the not knowing and keeping it within a particular group that allows that group to have something that somebody does not have. And so this is the same thing with excluding women from certain religious acts, or in Catholicism having an altar rail around the altar. It used to be that women were not allowed onto the altar unless they were cleaning it. And that what that does is it means that people who are allowed onto the altar are special. And so here you have, if you are not letting everyone to go into the temple, those people who do go into the temple, these are special people that have a certain privilege and a set of blessings that other people have to wait until they are at a certain stage in order to enter that. And so you're excluding a set of individuals, and that allows them to feel more power, a more special sense of themselves.
Are Mormons more secretive than others? Other religions? I think that was the essence of
Think that in the 20th and 21st century, I think that is the case. I think that the role of the temple is such an important part in LDS religion, and it's an exclusive space. So if you look at other groups, you'd have to talk, for instance, about Native American cultures, where there are societies that only certain men are privileged to go into. So yes, I would say that's a dimension of the religion that's unique.
It was interesting to look at the comments from the Deseret News. I think it's a pretty reliable place where you think you're going to find members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so some of the reaction to the video itself is interesting. Nina wrote from Provo. She says that I'm happy the video is out, but for me personally, I don't think this is a topic for discussion other than the fact that I'll simply point people to the video itself. Which is interesting to say this is not exactly going to give members permission to blab up a lot
It's obviously it's difficult to change. Yeah. And this was as anyone who's ever had a secret, to try to keep a secret, you know how stressful and problematic that can be. And so it's not going to be easy for people who have been told you must never say this. And in the 19th century, there were certain penalties that you would experience if you divulged certain things. It's a long tradition. And so all of a sudden to change it and to show these things that you've worked very hard not to show, change is difficult for everybody, and especially for people who are in religion.
Listen to this reaction from apparently an LDS person who wrote from London. This person wrote, "The video clearly violates the Church Handbook of Instructions. If I had made a video a few weeks ago showing the same things, I would have been excommunicated. These things are supposed to be sacred." So I'm not sure what kind of pushback you're getting like that, but there are still, as you can tell, I think members were going to feel really uneasy about that this is now.
So I was also looking at the internet in preparation for our conversation, and it seemed like it was going about two-thirds, one-third, with one-third of members saying, I don't like this. This does not make me happy. And I think that they have, again, it's in the context of many things. Maybe Joseph Smith's early celestial marriages didn't make people happy either. I mean, anytime you begin to open up something that has been closed, it's going to cause a lot of discomfort.
Here's something from Katie, who writes us from Highland, Utah. I'm a Mormon, and I'm glad you're covering this topic. Simply put, my temple garments are an outward expression of an inner desire to remember God in my daily life. They help me remember to try to be the kind of person I promised God I'll be, and they remind me how my physical and spiritual selves are interconnected. There is nothing hokey or mysterious about them, and I'm always happy to talk to people about them because I think they're one of the aspects of our religion that is greatly misunderstood. You heard a lot of that same kind of thing, didn't you?
Right, and I think she states this in a very beautiful way, but also what strikes me is that she says it's an outward expression, and yet it is not an outward expression. So you could say the same thing about a nun's habit, but that you can see, or even the hijab. The whole point of Muslim women wearing hijab is to express their religious commitments. But I don't know if Mormons are wearing their garments or not, and I know Mormons sometimes wear them and sometimes don't, and they wear them in ways to assert, you know, their availability for marriage, or their a place in the hierarchy, you know, they've been on their mission, or many other kinds of things. But you don't see this. You have to know the subtle clues. So the outward expression part, I think, again, is what Mormons are being told is the function of the garment, as opposed to the actual function of the garment.
It is interesting because you do write in the book that in many ways Latter-day Saints amongst themselves send these messages with garments. And you say it's hard to tell, I suppose, but there used to be this term, I'm not sure if it's apt anymore, because Mormon garments are now, at least for men, are crew necks. But they used to be these kind of V-neck. They used to be called the celestial smile. You used to hear that term all over the place. And that seemed to be a kind of signal that you were sending. So I guess Mormons know, right? Or have a sense of it anyway. They're sending a message.
Right. And I think that in the book I talk about dances where women would sort of feel to see if they could feel the garment, because that would say that the man had gone on a mission and he was ready to marry. And so this is how every religious object works. People use the object to communicate certain things that might have nothing to do with high-minded, you know, promises that they make to God.
Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Jeff is with us in Ogden, Utah. Jeff, hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I read a book a few months ago by a fellow named Leonard Swain called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. Is your guest familiar with that?
Why don't you tell me what you took away from that book?
Well, the author's theory is that male dominator or male priesthood religions originated from the written word. You can't read and write without using the left side of your brain. The left side of your brain is the rational side or the male side.
All right, hold on. Let me just raise the we're getting into the weeds here, and I don't want to. Forgive me, but what about the gender question? One of the things you do take note of is that while there are issues within Mormonism about whether women have the same kinds of rights or access and those kinds of things, perceived like a lot of Christian religions are as patriarchal, but the one of the things you do write about is the fact that Mormon temple garments are not that different between men and women. You want to talk about that?
And I think that the church actually makes that statement in the video. It tries to say that these garments are something which make all of us look similar. And I also think it's interesting because garments have also been referred to as priesthood garments. I notice the church is always talking about them in terms of temple garments. And I think that shift might be important because, of course, the question is, well, where are women in this priesthood mix? And so, you know, the notion that the clothing, the priesthood clothing, is similar between men and women, you know, tends to push us more into the notion that maybe men and women should be sharing these powers, this authority level.
801-585-WEST, the number two, join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Brian, are you with us?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just had a question about the secretive nature that outsiders see the temple. I'm a practicing LDS member, and in my mind, I would equate it more to a, not so much of an exclusion, the temple, but more of like an operating room where there are sanitary environments that are kept there for a special purpose. And the reason is for there's something that's special that's going on there. And whether you're a doctor or a nurse or just a regular person, in order to come in, you need to scrub in, you need to clean up because of the special activities that are going on in there. And the temple, I think us inside the church, we don't see it as trying to exclude people, because really, if you'd ask any Mormon, they would love for every person in the world to go to the temple and be in the temple. It's more of a preparatory stage that you have to get into because of the special environment, because of what's going on inside the temple that we try to maintain.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think you have a good point in terms of the notion of a space which is perceived as being pure, but the way that you construct or the way that you understand or define purity is to say this is pure and this is not pure. So, for instance, in the 19th century, if you were in a operating room, you could wear your long black frock coat and your big black hat and you were operating, because they didn't have a sense of what a germ was, and so they didn't worry about washing up. So the whole notion of what constitutes pure, how you define pure, the way you do that is to say this thing is pure and this other thing is not pure. And so if you have a temple recommend, you have a series of questions that you're asked, and you can be denied it because you're considered to be not pure. So as a historian, I would say, what are the characteristics that define that purity? And exclusion is one way of creating something which is pure.
You write about, I guess, liberal Mormons, or Mormons anyway, who have ambiguous feelings about their church at times. You say that often shapes the way they perceive their garments. What, if you are not entirely in, but you're still wearing garments, how do the ambiguous Mormons, as you put it, how do they relate to their garments in different ways from more Orthodox believers?
One of the things that you can do with garments, and actually with many things in the LDS culture, is you can wear them and you can think something very differently. You can believe something very differently. It keeps you a part of the community, so people recognize that you're a part of the community. But then in your own mind, you can have, you know, you can doubt, you can challenge, you can do all sorts of other things. One of the things I saw when I interviewed people was stopping to wear garments was an act when they were leaving the church, when they were exiting from the church.
It was a big deal.
Yeah, it was a serious thing. And so, and people who are trying, new converts, for instance, were trying to negotiate wearing garments, you know, they're trying to figure out, well, when can I wear, how can I manipulate it, you know, can I, what's legitimate? But because people haven't been talking about it, they don't always know. And I think the video will allow Mormons to talk more about the practical nature of the garments and also the theological nature of the garments.
So one of the things you write about is how garments are changing. And I'm wondering, it's been a while since you've sort of updated your conversations about all of this, but do you get a sense what younger Mormons are thinking about this? Do they have a different kind of relationship? Clothing styles are different. As you pointed out earlier in the program, I wanted you to kind of come back to this. Mormon garments have changed. I wonder if they continue to evolve as the church tries to sort of balance itself between, as you say, the idea of being mainstream, but also being different.
I think that the actual wearing of the clothing is probably not changing. So the notion that this is something important will continue. But the church is adapting materials and sizes and how, you know, different kinds of people wear that, what is useful. And so they will, that part of it will change. And I think young people also will begin to say, I'm very much committed to this religion, but I feel that God has told me that physically I can't wear this piece of cloth and I'm not going to wear it, but I'm still a good Mormon. And so I think there might be some flexibility in young people's minds about the role of the garment and when they can still be active and yet feel like, no, physically I cannot deal with this. I think that will happen more.
You write about the garment as a flexible boundary. I wondered if what you think in the, you kind of referred to it there a moment ago, but let me ask you this finally. So the video you think is going to, it's not going to get Mormons revealing certain aspects of their temple ordinances, but it is, you think, going to open up conversations that they can have that they didn't feel like they maybe could have before about how they wear them and when they wear them and all those other kinds of things?
Oh, I definitely think it's going to open up these kinds of conversations. And I think you were reading from the Deseret News. People will now point to the video. So somebody will ask a question and they'll say, oh, well, there's this video. Why don't you take a look if you're interested in what they look like? And I think that opens up a conversation, a wider conversation about the meaning, the theology behind it. And so people are going to be more open, I think, at this point. I think they'll still be uncomfortable because they've been taught that these are not conversations. And they'll be circumspect.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to be talking about things which are uncomfortable for them.
Do you think it's going to accomplish the goal that apparently, one of the goals anyway, of releasing the video for the church, that it will sort of strip away the weirdness a little bit for mainstream?
I don't
Americans?
Think so, because I don't think it's a lack of knowledge that people have and that they use derisive terms to refer to Mormons. I don't think it's because they don't know about it. I think it's because they want to be derisive. And so, no, I don't think it's going to change that.
That's Colleen McDaniel, professor of history and religious studies at the University of Utah. Her book is Material Christianity, Religion and Popular Culture in America. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Michael Shea. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.